evening. My name's Anita. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Anita.
Jim asked me if I would come down and be a speaker someday. He told me about this meeting he was putting together and helping out with, and I said, sure, why not? And the days creeped up on me really fast, and here I am. Although this afternoon I was sitting in another meeting, and I couldn't wait to get to this meeting. The reason for that is it was a tribal meeting. I belong to a tribe out in Lemoore, and these guys still drink, and they raise a lot of hell still, and they bring up a lot of crazy stuff. So my girlfriend was saying, well, it's a good meeting because these are sober people, and they're pretty mellow, so I hope that that's the case. My first encounter with alcohol, I was 6 years old. I was walking home from school. I was... We walked about 2 miles to get back and forth, and it was pretty hot, and I got home, and there was hardly ever any food in the refrigerator. There was always people drinking, and that's the only thing that was in the refrigerator. And there was this clear glass that I pulled out, and I took a big drink, and I just started choking, and violently, and I thought I was going to die because I couldn't catch my breath. And it happened to be... alcohol, some type of liquor, and I believe to this day it might have been something like vodka. And I remember grabbing the cup and pouring it down the sink, and I washed it because I wanted nobody else to get that violently sick off of what I just drank. My story ended, that was my drink. I loved it. But in between, I hear people talk a lot about born alcoholic. I don't know if I was born alcoholic. I know I was born around. I was born in the breeding grounds of an alcoholic. I was raised and bred on two different reservations. There was always partying going on. There was always a lot of drinking. I had two sides of the family. My father's side was very patriotic. My mother's side was very anti-social, which we called American Indian Movement. Very educated also. They wanted their kids to go to school and get an education. So I didn't fall under that family because I didn't want to be a kid with an education. I wanted to go out and party with everybody and all the kids on the other reservation. I ended up at 8 years old. Again, like I said, I don't believe I was an alcoholic. At 8 years old, my dad, he loved to hunt and fish, and I was always with my dad. I was constantly around him, and he had brothers who were winos, and they were half brothers. And my mom's uncles on my mom's side hung out with my dad's brothers, and they were winos. And I'm talking about the winos with the big cherry noses, and they were just scary for a little 8-year-old girl to see. I used to be terrified of them. And we would pull up into Porterville right below the reservation at the first store during the wintertime, and my dad would always buy two bottles of wine, and he'd wait for them to come up out of the orange crops, and they'd stay in those orange crops because of the stacks that they used to heat during the wintertime. And I asked my dad, because I said, why do they stay in there, Dad? And he says, because it keeps them warm in the winter. And I didn't know that they didn't have a home. I just knew that they'd come up soon, and they'd get the wine, and they'd get in with us, and we'd go up to the lake up above at Success Lake and do some fishing. Well, one day I was really freezing cold, and it was really cold. I couldn't get out there and fish with my dad because, like I said, I was his tail. And his brother said, well, why don't you give her a shot of this wine? So I took the shot of wine, and I don't believe I was an alcoholic, but, man, I love the way it made my ears warm and tingle. And even then I knew, you know, it was something pretty good. You know, that's why these guys always kept it. And they built a fire, so ended up they... This went on during that winter time, and it started to warm up. And one day we come pulling up, and the winos didn't come up out of the crops. And I'm wondering what's going on. Where they at? Where's my buddies? You know. And my dad told me while it's warming up, they must have went back up on the hill. So we go up to the lake, and what am I doing? I'm acting like I'm freezing. I'm saying, I'm just not that cold, but I'm freezing. I'm shivering. And I'm waiting for my dad to open it and let me have a drink, and he didn't. He just told me to go ahead and stay in the truck, and then I made a conscious decision right there to go ahead and bust that cap and drink some wine. The next thing I remember was my mom crying, and she's holding me and carrying me in the house, and I don't remember anymore. Still, I don't believe I was an alcoholic. I had the potential and the makeup of an alcoholic. I was 10 years old, my next drink, and I was at some friend's house, and my uncles were all drinking in one of the other rooms, and family members in the back part, and a friend of mine said, hey, we got some beer inside my room, let's go in there and drink. So I did, and I remember I was too afraid to walk out because I wasn't walking straight, and I wasn't walking funny. I was walking funny. And so I slipped out the back room, and I don't remember being that late being in that room, but I slipped out the window and took off, and I had my 10-speed with me, and I couldn't get the 10-speed to work. And I remember tipping it over, wondering why did it keep falling on me? Well, apparently I was just too drunk, and so I leave the bike there, and I'm walking, and my house wasn't too far from the house that I was at, and again, I get sick. You know, and still, it didn't dawn on me, it didn't occur to me that I might be alcoholic. I didn't think anything of it. You know, and I think back on it now, though, I remember one time eating a lot of enchiladas and I got sick, and I really don't care for enchiladas. They're all right, but I really don't care for them because of that. To this day, I don't like orange Kool-Aid because of the same thing. I drank a lot. But in my drinking, every time I got sick, it never had that same effect on me. I always needed more. And by the time I was 13 years old, I got to go back to this. So back on the reservation, on my dad's side, we didn't live in too much poverty on my dad's side. There was always people taking care of us. But on my mom's side, it was strictly poverty, and we were way up in the mountain area. If you guys ever been to Tule River, it's pretty isolated. And back up in 1971, it was pretty dark ages for me. It was the worst time of my life. Sometimes we'd get left up there, and there'd be absolutely no food, and my mom would be passed out in the front yard, and my dad would be passed out in the truck. And as kids would try to put them together and try to fix them up and take care of them and being hungry. And that was a life off and on. When I lived on my grandmother's reservation with my dad's mom, my dad's family were hunters, so we always had rabbits and cottontail, pheasant, and my grandma always had a side job where she was able to buy the flour and the big sacks of flour and rice and whatnot. So I loved living with my grandma. And she always made my bed and everything was always nice and clean. But back up on my mom's reservation, we began to sniff gas at a real early age, you know, getting on that gas, and we were all just kids, but there was never any supervision. Spent a lot of time down at the river. It was very, like I said, 1971, 72, probably till 75, it was very lonely living there. Growing up on my mom's side, my grandmother was very abusive towards me, but only me. My brothers and sisters, she loves them to death still today. She acknowledges them when we come around, still not me. Well, when I was growing up, she used to always tell me that I look like my dad, don't look at me, you have ugly eyes, and push me away, slap me. And she caught me playing with my uncle, who was her son, at the same age as me. I always got ripped out from the game and put away. You know, and it was a constant fear around that. It was always a constant fear around that family. I never knew what to expect. Never. Still at that time, I don't remember somebody saying, hey, let's go sniff some gas, or hey, let's go get drunk, or hey, let's go. It was just something that would happen for me. And I would just do it because other kids were doing it. And so again, I don't think I was an alcoholic at that time, but the potential was there, and don't get me wrong, I liked what it did for me as I was doing it. But I could honestly say by the time I was 16, 17 years old, I believe that my alcoholism had kicked in. And the reason why I say that, and I heard Father Leo say this, he said that the lion was disturbed in one of his speaker tapes, and I identified with that because one day I was drinking. And I don't remember feeling really very angry or very happy. I was just drinking, and it happened to be Easter Sunday, and it was drizzling rain, and this was down in Lemoore. And this grandmother that was abusive towards me, and I won't get into a lot of that. She was somewhat physical, but she was more verbal. She was more verbal. But she was I was about 16 years old, and she's in the kitchen, and they're blessing the food. And I remember the first thought when I seen that, my anger jumped up out there, and I'm thinking, what is she doing praying? She's a witch. She got no reason praying for her over all this food. And from there, all I could tell you is I went in and I destroyed all the food, which meant I destroyed everybody else's Easter Sunday, Easter dinner and whatnot. And it wasn't until the next day that I was criticized and put down and let down, and not once could I say why I done it. Not once could I jump up and say, hey, I did it because I was angry at my grandmother because of all the things she'd done to me. After that episode, my episodes became a lot more like that, and they came more frequent, and my drinking continued. I used to ride in rodeos. My dad's side of the family were all cowboys, and they were all big men, and they were really strong and handsome. And again, this was a side that was more patriotic, but they came back from the wars and whatnot, and they were cowboys, and they wore these big hats, and they'd always take me to the rodeos with them too. So the first thing I started doing was riding horses and riding calves and into intermediate bulls and the thing that I was getting out of it, I was terrified, but what I was getting out of it was, one, I got to drink with them. The other was, is I got a lot of pats on the back, and I enjoyed that. You know, and they'd always tell me, I'll never let nobody hurt you. Even as a little kid, I was growing up, and they'd never let nobody hurt me. And I always believed that, and I was always safe with that family. Well, I was 13 years old, and one of my dad's brothers got drunk one night and killed his other brother. And I remember waiting for my dad to get up and take control of this, because everybody was hurt and all he could do was stay drunk. I mean, I watched him sit on his bed and wake up from being drunk and ask my mom if it was true, and she'd say, yeah, Tony, it is. And he literally would just grab the bottle and drink himself right back into that sleep, you know, and pass right back out. And I remember being angry at him. I remember not wanting to walk through that back door. I wanted him to tell me how I was going to get through this, because this was my uncle's. I lost both of them, you know, and he should have been able to teach me that. And that never happened. So, again, I was growing up with some anger and some resentment. I was in the, and I'm going to jump back and forth through this, but I was in the sixth grade, in the first grade, and I'm just a little thing when I look back on my pictures. I'm just a little girl. I don't know anything. I look happy, you know. I remember I got sent home from a school in Lemoore, and my grandma sits on the bed with me, and she doesn't ask me about it or say anything. She's waiting for me to say why I got sent home. And she's looking through these books. And the reason why I got sent home is because, again, I just moved from my mother's reservation, and we weren't, I couldn't salute the flag. They said, we don't salute the flag. And they were very, you know, again, American Indian Movement. They told me why we didn't salute this flag. They told me stories that nobody else heard. So I didn't salute the flag. And I brought it up to my grandmother, and again, in her way of teaching, she's flipping through her book, and she starts showing me pictures of my uncles and great uncles and my grandfathers, and they're all in uniform. And she's telling me that these were good soldiers. She called them Sathathis, that they were good fighters, and that they weren't afraid to die, and that they would go to war, not because people took our land, is what she said. She said it was because it was still their land, and they were protecting them. You know, and it gave me, I remember feeling some sense of honor even at that age, but it was never taught to me. It was never given. That was as much as I got. Anyway, back and forth, my mind's flipping back. I had to play this, and I had to play this. I had to hide. It was constant. It was a constant battle growing up. You know, in high school, I did things that I thought the other kids wanted me to do, to act like an idiot, get an F, don't get an A, you know. don't go to the next basketball practice so you don't get to play basketball. I did those things because I was trying to fit in any group I could. And I was pretty damn good at everything that I'd done. I just never given myself and was never able to build myself up. My self-esteem was never up high enough to continue any type of achievement. I was always the one, like the book talked about, I'd build something just to pull the structure down from me. You know, and this was in my high school days, and this is when I don't think I was, again, the alcoholic. I knew it was kicking in. And, you know, I don't know where it began, but I started finding myself on different reservations all throughout California. And I don't remember how I got there or how long I stayed there. All I know is I was doing a lot of partying. I ended up working out at the, it used to be the Southgate Bingo Palace. It was the company that's out there now, which is the Apache Palace Hotel and Casino. Before it was just this little bingo parlor. And I did a lot of drinking while I was working there. And I got a couple of people fired one night, and I was about 18 years old. And again, I started realizing my drinking's really kicking in. It's really kicking in right now. I was lying a lot. I was coming to work drunk a lot. I was being threatened to be let go. I was running this till, and there was these two really nice ladies who taught me how to deal cards and make tips and make money. And all the card players, they really enjoyed me because I was a character. I'd make them laugh, and they'd tip me. And anyway, I'm running this till, and I decided I needed a drink, and I started realizing I can take a little out of this till, and I wasn't going to get caught because there's too many people's hands in this till. And one night, though, you know what they say, the more you take, you need more, and you need more, and one night I needed just that much. And so I decided I could take $900, and I was with my brother, and I wanted to impress him, too, and get him drunk, and he was my older brother, and, you know, and I can stay up with him, you know, and show him that I was a big shot too, because he was in and out of prison since he was 18, and he's still living that life. But I ended up stealing all this money, and it was a big thing, and they made a big deal out of it, you know. And I'm sitting back, and everybody thought I was just the coolest little kid working for them, and I really was. I mean, I was always talking to people, on, you know, and whatnot, because I knew that's what they wanted. And anyway, the two ladies got suspended, and they had to pay the $900 back, but one of the ladies got fired, you know. And I never knew I was going to have to deal with that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. If they would have told me that, I think I would have been too afraid to do anything like that. I didn't know what a fourth step was. But by the time I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had two kids during my drinking, and one of them, my oldest child, I turned into the drunk. They let me go from my job. My house, I had no electricity. I had no hot water. I didn't pay my, I had no telephone. I had the couch, the couches where you could, they have none of the balls on the bottom aren't there anymore. The little legs ain't there. The arms have you could see the 2x4 or whatever that is, 4x4. My TV was broke, but it was there because it took up room, you know. Pile missing on my floor, and I had food and holes in my walls. And I had and I was just in the pits. I didn't like the life I was living, but I didn't know that there was any other way to live. And my two kids, I drank myself into such an obsession, you know. I didn't know if I was coming or going. And when I share this, I identified with a lot of alcoholics who said, when they talked about their blackouts, you know, it really made me take a look at that, because I would come to in a blackout. One day I was, and this is many times, but I remember waking up, and I always terrified when I first wake up. I don't know about you guys, but I would be terrified the moment I woke up. And I didn't know what type of position I was going to be in. I didn't know if I'd have my clothes on. I didn't know whose room I was going to be in. I didn't know if I was going to find my car. I didn't know if I was going to, you know, none of those things. Where I was, if I was going to be on this reservation or who the people were on the other side that wall. I didn't know those things, and I'd be terrified. And like always, I'd clean myself off with my best fit, and I really would. I'd try to fix myself up. I owned a blue shirt, and that's all I wore because that's all I owned. I had no shoes. I literally had no shoes. I was, again, when I say poverty, I drank with winos. I would come up on a what we call the tire fires, you know, literally burning tires, and all the winos drinking their white port and their Thunderbird, and I'm sitting there drinking with these guys, you know, and sometimes we'd have the luxury of finding an old abandoned shack or an old abandoned garage, somebody's garage would do, you know, and I remember it being freezing cold, and my life went on this way for a while, and again, I had these two kids, and I didn't know how to take care of them, and there was moments I tried, there was moments I'd really try to be, to straighten up, and I just didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to cook, I didn't know how to clean, I didn't know how to work, I didn't know how to feed them, I didn't know how to take care of myself, I didn't know how to bathe myself. There were so many things I did not know how to do, and again, I'm 18 years old with my first child, and my mom ends up taking a lot of that responsibility away from me, so I continue my drinking, and I progressively get worse, and you know, I came into the mind of thinking once I got my own place, everything was going to be okay, you know. And once I got my own place, nothing was okay. All I was now alone, you know. And I had all these responsibilities that I had no idea how to do or take care of. And there were times when my best friend lived about three houses down the road, and this disease already killed her. She passed away about 5 years ago, a fatal accident, brutal, very brutal. But she, I remember I'd wake up or I'd wait for her to get home, either whatever, and it didn't matter what time, but this would happen so many times. By now I have two kids and no gas or no electricity, and they'd be sleeping in the room, and all I could think of was, well, they're asleep. I'll go walk down here and I'll drink a couple of beers and I'll come back. And that, I never come back. Ever come back. And these babies are only a year and 2 years old. And then somebody would find them and they'd call. I've had CPS called on me. I've had my mother call. I'd rather have CPS than my mother. My dad would come over and bawl me out, you know, and I was just, my dad, when he bawled me out, he literally would just gun me down with all those ugly words, you know, and I'm not going to say them today, but you know what I'm talking about. And it made me feel even more insecure and more worse about myself. And how could I tell him, Dad, I don't know how to be a parent? I don't know how to tell him, Dad, I don't know how to pay my bills. I don't know how to tell him, Dad, I need your help. I didn't know how to do any of those things. Throughout my drinking about my grandmother, beautiful, beautiful woman, the one who made sure that I was fed growing up and put me in school and taught me. One time she caught me sniffing paint and she didn't talk to me for 3 months, literally. And I literally would follow this woman around. I had some good times too, don't get me wrong. I have a lot of good times in my childhood. My grandma used to take me up to the mountains and she taught me how to go and dig roots for all the basket weaving that she done. My grandma's a professional basket weaver, and she's well known. There's a couple of books that she's in, and it's pretty neat when people who really study the basket weaving will say, "Your name's Anita Vega, is Rose Vega, your grandmother?" Yeah, well, you know, they just start getting all into it, and I'm like, "Yeah, cool," you know. But I never learned how to make the basket. And my grandmother told me that is because I never had the patience, that I wasn't a basket weaver. She used to tell me, "You're the gatherer." Now, I don't know if that was her way of getting me to get into the mountains and go far down and do a lot of digging. It could have been. But and I took that honor, and I was always proud of that, still am today. And people talk about it, say, I'm the gatherer. You know, that's what I do for my family. And so anyway, back to my grandma, through my drinking, I abused the heck out of her. And I mean, verbally, not physically. I mentally abused her. I was the drunk who would sit there and beg her for her last $10. and she'd end up giving it to me after she told me she didn't have it over and over and over. I was the granddaughter who would borrow and borrow and borrow her car and never ever bring it back with gas or never bring it back clean, and there was always pee, there was always food, I mean, you name it, it was in, and it was disgusting. And I'd bring that back to her, and my poor grandma would be out there cleaning up my mess. Sure, she'd be mad at me, but she'd, again, I was such a nuisance. I was just such annoying to her. She'd give it to me, you know. And there was times when I'd bring the party to her house, you know. One time we had a water fight in our living room, and she woke up and she bawled me out and she tried to kick me out, and I wouldn't leave, and we still stayed there and partied, you know. Listened to music all night long in her garage and didn't really care about what, you know, it's just grandma. I was also the drunk who would always go and tell her, "Grandma, clean your car for this, or I'll mow your lawn." It was mainly her lawn. "I'll mow your lawn." My grandma had a pretty big yard, you know. And I'd tell her, "Grandma, mow your lawn, you give me $10. Well, the first time she did it, and I didn't mow her lawn. So the second time I did it, she gave me the $10, and I half-assed it. I didn't turn everything over and mow it great, you know. I just did a shitty job on it, and that got worse. It really did. It turned into where I'd only do so much of it, and I'd go in and beg for the money and then leave. And that was constant. It was constant that I'd do that. I constantly begged her for her car. I constantly begged her for her last $10, you know. And one night, needing to continue my drinking because I had progressed already, and I ended up selling her car in the bar. I ended up selling it. I used to break horses also at a young age. I was like 17, and I tell you, my poor horses, I tell you, they'd run across the reservation still with their saddle on 3 days later. And I'd be terrified to ask how long has the horse had the saddle on, because I already would get bawled out for that. I've been bawled out so many times for that. I didn't make it to any of my doctor's appointments. I never made doctor's appointments. Yeah, I didn't need to. I diagnosed myself, you know. When I started learning about, when I talked about my disease started coming out, and I'm having blackouts, or I'm waking up in blackouts, I thought I had a brain tumor, and that's what I told myself. So I'm going to die anyway. You might as well continue your drinking, you know. And I had bad teeth, bad skin, bad smell, bad clothes, bad everything, you know. And I never thought I looked good. Not even in my drinking did I feel pretty. You know, I had to constantly keep myself drunk and intoxicated. And I didn't, towards the end of my drinking, when I say the end of my drinking, I was only 22 when I got here. I was 22 years old, and I didn't have enough. I was told it was time to quit, you know, and I don't think I was ready to do this. But through all my blackouts, I would get out of my car, and I was always constantly trying to redeem myself in front of family. I always was trying to do that. Because I know there were times, even if I was semi-intoxicated or sober, which wasn't much, I would tell my mom and them, if they wanted to send me to the store, I'm going to do it. I'll go get the milk, and I'll go get the eggs, and I'll come back with crazy shit like syrup and sugar. You know, and then I'd get bawled out for that. Constantly. And then if I was drinking, I didn't come back at all. And if I was drunk, I swear I would get out of Save Mart or wherever store I was going to, and I'd get out and I'd forget what I was there for, and then I'd really get terrified because, did my mom or my dad send me here? Man, I'm really going to get it, you know. And this foot would be halfway out, and I didn't know if this was the foot getting in or getting out. I didn't know which way I was going. And so, again, I was no longer waking up terrified. I was living in fear. My life, I constantly was in fear. I didn't know what I said yesterday. I don't know who I met yesterday. I don't know what I talked about. I did not know. Back to breaking horses. Like I said, I was really good at things. People used to come and watch me break horses at my grand's house. I was about 16, 17 years old. And I'm drinking, you know, and I'm cocky as hell, too. And I used to ride my horses all the way out to this little store and buy a bottle of whiskey and ride back. But I was always on my horses, and my horses always had saddles on, whether I was on them or off them, you know. And I had this Appaloosa. I had several really nice horses, and I used to not only did I break them, but I also kept them pinned up for shelter for other people out there. And so I was, at that time, I was making pretty decent money for the age I was and the time that was. And I was doing what I loved to do. It's just I was doing it drunk. And anyway, about this Appaloosa, I was offered $1,400 for her. And that was a lot of money back then. And she was high. She was beautiful. She was just the best horse you could ever ride. And I was very proud of that horse, and I loved her. Her name was Nally, and yeah, I named my horse Nally. But it was pretty neat. You know, she was just a beautiful horse, very fast. And my mom used to tell me I was as crazy as the horses I broke, because sometimes I couldn't break them. I mean, they were just nutheads, and so was I, though, and I continued to try. But back with Nally, this guy on the reservation ended up offering me $800 for her. And I thought, man, where's the guy that offered me the 14? And by now, I kind of want this money. And a couple of months later, he offered me $600 for her. And I had her bred, and she was getting ready to have this colt. And I was at the bar one night, and he was there, and he says, hey, I'll give you $300 for that horse. And I took the $300, and I remember the next morning being so angry and just upset at myself and just disgusted in me, you know, and I can't just go over there and go get that horse out of the pen. It no longer belongs to me. And about 2 weeks later, she had this beautiful filly. I mean, I was so sick of me. I really was. And I couldn't stop my drinking, you know. My oldest daughter, you know, again, my incomprehensible demoralization and just not knowing if I was coming or going. Who puts a two-year-old in the back of a pickup truck, a four-wheel drive lifted? I do, because that's where they belong, you know, out of my hair and in the back, and that's what I did. I put her in the back. All I remember her was just running around in the back, and I'm thinking, what is she doing? Why isn't she sitting down? She's 2 years old. And I turn around this corner, and the next thing I know, I look in the rearview mirror, and I see this little baby dusting herself off crying, and she's wiping herself off coming up to the road, and she's crying. She's crying. And I still don't have the common sense to stop for her. I drive all the way down a mile before I turn around to come back to get her. I didn't tell nobody this. I did not tell my mom. I did not tell my dad. You know, forget that noise. You know, and the same child, I was in the back of my dad, I was in my dad, at my dad's house, and everybody was running around, and I remember I'm driving this little gray car, and there was the puddles in the ground. Well, there's no water in there, dry puddles, but she's playing in one of them, and I just back right up over her. Don't even see her, don't even think about it. All I know is when I stopped, I heard the baby crying, I get out, my dad's bawling me out because he's standing there. You know, and he's just letting me have it. He's just drilling me, you know. And all I can keep thinking now is, why is you so mad at me? Damn it, you were there. You should have got her. You should have known better. It's not my fault. I ran over her. And I shit you not, the very next week, if within that time frame, I run over the same child, same car, same spot. Now I'm mad at her because didn't she see what happened last week? Shouldn't she have moved, you know? And again, no comprehension. It's just not there. It's not there to think that I'm just gone. There's nowhere else for me to go. You know, and again, when I say I didn't get into Alcoholics Anonymous willingly, I really didn't. I had many blackouts, and my very last drunk happened on March 8th, 1989. I don't know if it was a real drunk because I didn't even have a blackout, and it's just bizarre to me, and I know God working in my life then because I didn't know what I was doing, because usually my blackouts ended up to where if I started drinking, I didn't come home for 3 or 4 days. My blackouts were long blackouts, and I stayed away from the reservation for days. And that night, I decided I was going to go ahead and go see my friend. The kids were sleeping. I'm okay. And I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to get drunk, and for whatever reason, I could not get drunk. I was supposed to go into a treatment that morning at 10, the next morning on the 9th at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I remember looking up at the clock and I'm getting frustrated because I can't get drunk. My friend's already out of it. And I just thought to myself, you know what, I'm just going to go on home. And I did. I went on home. I made it home that night. next morning, 10 o'clock, my mom didn't come pick me up. She called me, said, there's some things going on. And I already had made my mind up that I wasn't going to go. And she says, you're going. And I said, oh, okay, whatever, you know. And I hung up, and she came back and picked me up. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on March 9th, and she picked me up to this treatment center. The thing that upset me is not only did my mom pick me up, but my two sisters were with her, and they drank like I drank. And I was upset about that. I really was. There were two of them sitting right there in the back, you know, waiting for me to get in. They took me up to the reservation. That was my darkest ages. It really was. And the first night I got there, and I'm thinking, there's this one gal, she's half white, half Indian, but I didn't look at the Indian, I just looked at the white, and I'm thinking, what is she doing out here? I was mad, you know, and again, I was raised with a lot of prejudice. I truly was. When I came into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't see white or black, I just seen white. I don't care if you were black, I don't care if you were Mexican, I don't care if you were Indian, you were white to me. And I really did hold on to that. I was very angry, very vicious, you know, just a lot of anger inside me, and I was one of the alcoholics who came in, and I had to hold myself, and I rocked back and forth, and I literally would do that. I would rock back and forth, and I held myself a lot. And I see them still today. I see those alcoholics still come in, and they're wondering what they're doing here, you know. And I know that if they keep coming back, they're going to get this program. But back with working this program, now that I'm up in this treatment center, I catch on, and I'm going to this meeting. My first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting was a meeting on a Thursday night. It was a meeting up in Springville. It was called the, I can't even remember the name of the meeting now. I walked into this meeting, and everybody had 8 years or more, you know. And I remember Herman come up to me. Some of you may remember some of these guys, but Herman come up to me. My very first meeting, he hands me candy, and I think, what a pervert. You know, I really did. And he's asking me how I'm doing and whatnot, and I'm thinking, what do you care, you know? So I keep going to this meeting, and I'm hanging in there, and I'm listening to people, and I really don't like going, and I can't get up and go to the bathroom because I'm too ashamed of myself. I'm too ashamed of the way I look. I'm too ashamed of the way I feel. All this guilt, everything that I feel. I was the kid who would go to the swimming pool and could not get in the swimming pool. I was the kid who would go to the skating rink and could not get on that skating rink floor. Only until the last 15 minutes could I enjoy myself. It was when everybody was getting out. It was when everybody's getting ready to go home. And again, this all come from the abuse from my grandmother. Again, I had ugly eyes, don't look at her, slap me, take me away from family members, you know. I actually, when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to see a psychiatrist. And it was my first 3 months of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen a psychiatrist as well as going to meetings. You know, my going to these meetings up in Springville it started becoming pretty fun because this one gal, the same gal that I seen, the half Indian, half white girl, started taking me to these outside meetings, and she started buying me cigarettes, and she started buying me soda. And I thought that was real cool, you know, and it gets me out of the program. And so I'm volunteering now. I'm ready to go. When's the next meeting, you know? Anyway, we continued doing that for a while, probably for the next 6 months, you know. And I started meeting some of you people, and I was hanging out with you guys, and I was doing things that I didn't want my tribal member friends to see me doing with you guys. I actually was sitting in, I would go down to Perko's, and man, if I seen a tribal member, another Native American, walk in from my reservation, I would literally hide from them. I really would, because I didn't want them to see me with you. You know, and I remember feeling that way, you know, and it was just a lot of shame. There was a lot of guilt going on. But I ended up finding me a sponsor. I got to go back home after a while, and I went back home to the same house with the white, or it had a yellow trim. It had two chairs. One was busted, and they were the ugliest chairs. I still remember them. They were the ugliest looking chairs, and the round table, you know, and the holes in the wall was still the same food stains in it, and the same broken TV. But I got to go back to that. And I got my kids back. And I go to a meeting, and my sponsor would tell me, give your kids a bath. And I didn't know I was supposed to do that, so I'd give them a bath. She'd ask me, did you feed your kids today? I said, well, I didn't know I was supposed to, you know. I didn't know how. They taught me how to shop. They really did. I had a couple of friends who would take me to the market and help me do my shopping. And they'd tell me, hey, this is real easy stuff to cook. All you got to do is read it. Well, I'm illiterate. I don't know how to read. You know, so they teach me how to do these things, you know. And that was my first encounter with Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I almost didn't go to this treatment center because I didn't have a pair of shoes. I literally was barefooted. And I came this close of not going because, again, shame and humiliation, embarrassment. You know, anyway, I ended up sticking around in this treatment center and hanging out with people who would take me to meetings and whatnot, and then I get to go home and I started going to conventions and I'm hanging out with, and I'm starting to have fun. I haven't started working the steps yet, but I'm starting to have fun. And then I ended up getting a sponsor, and then I started working the steps, you know, and I identified myself as an alcoholic way before I found my sponsor. I just didn't want to tell you guys I was alcoholic, you know, I believed in a God. I just didn't know if he believed in me. I didn't know if he was going to accept me because, I'm Native American, and he probably wanted nothing to do with me. A lot of shame, a lot of guilt. Goes back to my grandmother. I'm actually still seeing a psychiatrist, not today. Take that back. I'm not seeing a psychiatrist today, but I was seeing a psychiatrist then. I learned a lot. I really did. I not only was I coming to believe and turning my will over to the care of God, and my sponsor always had me reading, and even though I didn't know how to read that well, because I'm trying to figure this out, and everything was so foreign, and I'd call her and I'd be crying, I'd be mad, just crying. I don't understand this. And I was getting tired of having to ask her for all these things to explain, you know, step three to me. I was getting tired of her. I was getting tired of me having to ask all these things, you know, but she stuck with me, man. She really did. I tell you, my sponsor was there at any time of the day. She truly was. And if you don't have a sponsor like that, you really need to find one. Because I can call her at 4 a.m. and she'd say, come on over if you can. If you can't, go to sleep because there's nothing you can do. It's 4 a.m. You know, sometimes I twitch and I turn, you know, but she walked me through all these things. She really did, you know. I ended up doing my third step, and then I started working on my fourth step, you know, and after doing my fourth step again, I knew I had these amends. I needed to take a look at me. I had to look at my shortcomings because I was violent. I was very vicious, you know. I was the type, my kids, I'd go into the store with them to buy them clothes for school, and if that person on the other side of the counter pissed me off, I don't care how much clothes and how much these kids love these clothes, I'd get up and walk out. Well, I didn't get up and walk out. I'd just walk out, you know. And my poor kids would be crying because they're following me, you know. But that's the shortcomings. That's just part of it, you know. But I ended up getting to make my amends to my grandmother. I motored along for 5 years, never asked her for another dime. Not because I thought I was making amends, but my sponsor told me to mow her lawn, never ask for another dime. Never ask, even if she offered it. You take her to the store in her car, and you never ask for a dime. You just don't ask for nothing. You just do what Grandma says. So I did it for 5 years. My five-year birthday, I'm playing with my little medallion, and I'm flipping it on her bed, and she picks it up. She says, what's this? I said, Grandma, I've been sober for 5 years. And she looked at me. She says, I think I'll keep this. And she kept it. Right then and there, I knew I had made my amends. I knew that was a part of a working amends. It wasn't actually apologizing to her. How could I apologize? My grandma's car broke down while one of my other cousins were driving it. I was furious with my cousin. I wanted my cousin to fix it. My sponsor says, no, you fixed it. You sold her last car. You owe her a car. You know, I was able to get all this stuff and get rid of it and understand that this was part of working these steps to getting back to life, to getting back to healthy. My other grandma, you know, I've done a lot of work on me to get to where I'm at today. My self-esteem, sometimes they'll kick in, but I'm out to tell you, hey, I can't go sit and eat lunch with you, and I tell them why. I'm not feeling up to it. My self-esteem is low right now, and I really don't want to push myself today. And I do tell people that, you know. If I don't feel up to it, I won't do it. And so, I don't know. I was always told that I need to tell why I'm making my amends back to the three ladies, the two that got suspended and had to pay the money back for my doing. When I made my first, the lady, and I knew that I didn't make the amends if I wasn't completely willing to take whatever was next. And I remember the lady who gotten fired, she was the first person I made an amends to. And I swear, when she came up to me, she's about where I was when I stopped drinking. And I felt so bad for her. And I explained to her the same thing the way the book told me to, the way my sponsor told me to. I tell her why I'm making amends, why I did what I did, and that I truly am sorry and that I give myself to God. And when I did that, she didn't even care about what, all she wanted was the $40 that I still owed her. Didn't even comprehend anything I just told her. The other two ladies that I made the amends to told me that they were very happy and very proud of me that I had made it out of the drinking that I had done because they started to see my drinking. You know. So again, I'm not saying it'll always be that way because I did get slapped in the face one time for making amends. Probably I shouldn't have made it at that time. My timing's not always perfect. But, you know, things continue to get better for me. They really do. I had a brother who I was coming up on my 9 years sober, and he had been diagnosed with cancer. And a really good friend of mine with 23 years in the program, I called him first because he had been dealing with two people in his family that had just recently died from cancer. So I called him first, and the first thing he tells me after I tell him what type of cancer, he says, are you prepared? He says, where you at right now? I said, I'm home. I'm sitting on my kitchen counter. He says, I'm going to tell you something. He says, and I want you to know I love you. He says, but you need to prepare yourself because your brother is very sick and he's going to die. And that I was angry at for a minute. And as soon as I wanted to hang up that phone, I knew I couldn't. I knew he was only telling me what I needed to hear. I knew. And he says, Anita, God did not bring you this far in the program and let you understand him and know him to leave your brother where he's at. Your brother is afraid. He's only 22 years old, and you got to go tell him about God so he does not die alone and he doesn't die in that fear. For 3 months, I went to the hospital and stayed in the hospital and spent all that time with him. And I tell you, the last week before he went back to the hospital and he didn't come home no more, he said, Sister, I love you. He says, and I believe the way you believe. My little brother used to do AA dances for Hanford. He used to go to conventions with me. He was only 12 years old, and until he was about 16, he got to do all these things. And when he told me he loved me, he said he wanted to look at me, and I was just like, what's going on? And he says, I love you. He says, I want you to know I'm not afraid to die. He said, it's actually an honor for me to go first. He said, I can't go. He says, I'd hate to be here and you go before me. And he also told me that, he says, you know, I look back on my short life, and he said, the best time I ever had in my life was participating and going to those conventions and doing those AA dances for you, hanging out with my friends, riding around at night and hanging out. You know, I became a sister, I became a mother, I became a friend, I became a lover, I became a worker, I became all these things in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a newcomer and you don't know what else to do, I was told there was only three things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous and you will stay sober. And I listened up real hard because I want to know what those three things are. And that is, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink. Thank you.